Hello and welcome to the House of Comments. I'm Mark Thompson. I recently went to Lib Dem Conference. Actually, I say I went to Lib Dem Conference. I kind of went along to Brighton and then I ducked in and out of fringe events and met up with various people. I didn't actually buy a conference pass because I'm not a member anymore. But I did manage to grab a few interesting people to talk to about their thoughts. So I interviewed initially Nick Barlow, who is a Lib Dem member and councillor. I also interviewed Mark Pack, who's a Lib Dem member and kind of long-term insider, knows a lot about kind of what's going on with the party. And then I also interviewed John Elledge, who is a journalist for The New Statesman, who was attending some fringe events and speaking to people himself. And then finally, I caught up with Jenny Rigg, who is also a long-term member of the Lib Dems. I've known her for many years. She's been very active in the blogosphere and so forth. She had some interesting things to say too. So I hope you enjoy these interviews. I apologise for any sound issues because I was just recording it on my phone as I was actually there. There's some background noise and having listened back to the audio, some of my voice is a little bit distorted in some places. Happily, it seems that my guests seem to have better voices for that sort of recording. And seeing as it's them that's talking the most, you'll be pleased to hear. Hopefully it won't be too bad. Anyway, I hope you enjoy the interviews. So I'm delighted to be joined by Nick Barlow, who is a Lib Dem activist and a councillor in Colchester, and actually a cabinet member in Colchester. But he's talking today in a personal capacity on his reflections of how Lib Dem conference are going. How are you doing, Nick?
I'm good, thanks.
Good. Thanks for joining me today. So we're talking on Sunday afternoon, so conference is already in full swing. I'm a cheapskate, so I haven't bothered actually buying a conference pass, not least because the media prices are extortionately expensive. So I've just been wandering in and out of fringe events. But I'm kind of taking the temperature. I've been speaking to a few people and picking up on stuff. From your perspective, how do you think conference is going this time?
So far, I think it's interesting. It seems quite busy and quite a lot of people around issue and things like that. But yeah, I think the one thing that's dominating everything is sort of the Vince's bombshell he dropped last week about the bringing in the supporter scheme and changing the way we elect the leader. And that's, when I've had conversations with people, that seems to be the dominant thing rather than anything actually being discussed in the conference at the moment.
I know, I saw that you wrote a piece on your Medium account about that. You kind of addressed all the questions in the supposed consultation, I'll put in quotes. Some of the questions did seem a little bit leading to me in the way that these things often are when political parties trying to get a response to something and they're trying to nudge everyone in a certain direction. But what's your general feeling about the main points of that? They're talking about trying to open things up a little bit like Labour did with having a kind of affiliate membership that actually you don't need to pay anything for. I think in the case of Labour, they were charging £3, weren't they? I think These proposals are suggesting it would be completely free and all you need is an email address.
Well, it's an email address and you need to have to be registered on the electoral roll, but someone actually has to check that.
Right.
So that's the thing is with I think with these proposals, I think actually it's quite interesting that you mentioned Labour because I looked back to some of the coverage from 2014 at the time and some of it's quite interesting, you know, almost identical to the sort of coverage we're getting now. And sort of Ed Miliband was saying at the time that, you know, this wasn't quite using the same words, but the idea was by bringing in supporters who didn't have to be party members, you'd get this great moderate mass of people who'd want to join the Labour Party.
I mean, that worked out well for Labour, didn't it?
There's a column by John Rentoul talking about how this guarantees the next leader of the Labour Party will be a Blairite. And so things like that was people didn't really think, or I think they thought it might attract some, but the left, so using scare quotes there, the left isn't big enough to worry about even if they all joined. And I don't think they actually envisaged the effects they would have. And I think, again, the problem with these is these proposals come out and people haven't really thought out the consequences. They've got this idea that there's this mass of moderates that want to sign up for a party. But the way I see it is within, you know, if you look on the internet, basically the sheer level of arseholery, the sheer number of people who will just do something just because it's a bit of a laugh, I think outnumbers the number of people who might be a bit moderate and want to choose a Lib Dem leader. And I think given the right cause, you could end up with, and the fact that now it doesn't cost them anything except signing up and getting your email, I think there's a big risk there, and I think there's a bit of naivety in just assuming that you're going to appeal to this mass of moderates
by
doing it.
In the case of Corbyn, though, I mean, I was very much a Corbyn skeptic, I suppose you would call it. In fact, I very briefly joined the Labour Party during the attempted challenge to his leadership in 2016 in order to try and vote for someone else. As it happened, I didn't. I can't remember. There was some detail about it. I joined at the wrong time and I couldn't do it, so I very quickly unjoined. I was a member for about 2 weeks. But because I wanted to try and save the Labour Party from itself, but then the 2017 general election sort of proved me wrong in that Corbyn came pretty close to winning, and now there is serious talk that he could be our next Prime Minister. So is it necessarily a bad thing to open up the membership with this affiliate status for the Lib Dems, in that maybe the loads of people will join as affiliate members and then will nudge the party in a direction that ends up with a leader that actually might do really well? It's possible, isn't it? I mean, where the party is at the moment in the polls can't get much worse, can it?
I don't think it can get much worse in terms of polls. I think the position I come from is that I see, in a way, I'm sort of in the Corbyn position here, that Corbynist supporters see the Labour Party as the vehicle for socialism in Britain, and so they're restoring it from the moderates and the centrists taking it over and making it, and yeah, that's a whole other argument which you won't have here about the role of the Labour Party. But my problem is that with a lot of the things that are being proposed and a lot of things that are being talked about, is the key word for me in the name of the Liberal Democrats is liberal. And I worry that with a lot of this appeal, talk about appealing to moderates and centrists and people who are just sort of generally in the middle type thing, is that you end up, it may turn out to be electorally successful. However, I think there's a flaw in that logic. But what profit a man if he gains the world but loses his soul? What's the point? Do you just want to be a party that wins power for the sake of winning power? Or are you trying to win it for a cause? And I think this is the problem, is that when I was saying earlier about the main topic of conversation around conferences, this membership scheme, the supporter scheme and all that, and all the news around it is being sent, most of the news around it is being centred around that, rather than any policies or what the party stands for.
So it's sucking the oxygen out of all the other stuff, basically.
Yeah, that's it. Well, if you ask someone what the Lib Dem do, aren't they the ones who let anyone elect their leader? The question is not what does the Lib Dem stand for and what policies are they going to do. That, and this is the problem that we were going into before this conference, that we've had since coalition, is what do Lib Dems mean? What do they want? We need, I think, to find a clear answer to that, because the problem, the point with Labour is that it was arguing with Corbyn, it was arguing over social democracy versus socialism versus whatever, but they were all within that sort of this is what the Labour Party is for. These are the policies, this is how we deliver that. The point with the Liberal Democrats is we haven't had that, we don't have that clear vision of what we're about. To try, and I'm not sure that that's necessarily going to attract people anyway. It's just a party it's there. It's not actually saying we're standing for this, come and join us in fighting for this. It's we're a bit moderate, do you want to come and be a bit moderate with us?
Long-term listeners to the podcast will know that I used to be a Lib Dem. For a few years, from 2008 to 2013. One of the things I was quite surprised about when I was a member was how many people I would talk to, maybe in my local party and also sometimes at events and stuff, who would espouse ideas, and it was clear their core principles were not very liberal at all. They seemed to be Lib Dems without really being liberals. I mean, the guy who was, I won't say who it was, but there was someone who was pretty senior in our local party, and some of the stuff he was saying wouldn't have been out of place in UKIP, really.
Oh, yeah, I think that's it's the issue. It's one of the things I've heard raised in the sort of consultations over the supporter scheme, is that people go, I think I heard someone say yes at one thing. Oh, they did the survey and 67% of people said they're centrists. So we could get 67% of the people backing us. And I think the problem is when you do that sort of survey, is this in my other life as an academic, this is the sort of thing I'm looking at, centrism. You ask people questions, sort of say, and it's normally on a 1 to 10 scale, 1 is extreme left, 10 is extreme right, where would you place yourself? Well, first, most people don't really think politically in that way. And second, when you ask people, are you extreme this or extreme that, they'll go, oh, no, actually, I'm a bit in the middle. Most people don't want to define themselves as extreme. So people think they've not gone through this process of thinking, these are my political views, these rate me at a 3.7 on the left-right scale. Like, oh, I'm a bit... we want to assume we're average and that sort of thing. We want to assume that most people think like us, have the same beliefs as us, so we're going to place ourselves in the middle. So saying people identify as centrists doesn't mean people hold Liberal Democrat values.
Mm.
And that's the problem, I think, is that assuming one thing doesn't... then we're assuming this one thing about people saying they're centrists, and then when you actually look at... you know, people like Stephen Kinnock calls himself a centrist, but I can't really see him fitting in the Liberal Democrats given some of his views on immigrants and social democracy and all that. But people say, you know, you can't, there are many roads to be in the centre. I think just assuming... and this, I think, is the thing with Liberal Democrats, because we haven't had... sorry, to go back to your question... the point, because we've had that bit of not having a clear identity of what we're for politically, where even if they're unclear, people know roughly what Labour stand for and what the Tories stand for on left. Yeah, they know roughly left and right what they might mean. With us, it's that. And so you end up with a lot of people who join because, well, then we're not one of them, not one of the other. I want to be politically involved. I'll do it with them. And then because we don't really have a big political argument as tradition where people's views like that get questioned, and also a thing where someone is a good campaigner, yeah, which means they're very good at going around and pointing at potholes and the like, and so that for them that counts as, oh yeah, well, it doesn't matter, you know, that so-and-so is, you know, wants to round everyone he disagrees with up in bloody concentration camps, look how many leaflets he delivers,
look how many potholes he's pointing.
Yeah.
So another of the proposals that Vince has put forward is the idea that the next leader of the Lib Dems will not necessarily need to be a member of Parliament, which has been the rule up until now. Now, instinctively, when I first heard that, I suppose I had a couple of little contradictory thoughts. The first thing is, yeah, I can sort of see that. There's only 12 MPs. Two of them have already been leader now, Tim Farron and Vince Cable. It's not a huge pool. And there are a lot, having been in the Lib Dems and having interacted with Lib Dems over many years, there are lots of really talented people in the Lib Dems, plenty of whom aren't MPs and who could probably do a good job as leader, I would imagine. But at the same time, it slightly starts to look defeatist, as if the Lib Dems aren't really expecting to get loads more MPs at the next election, and therefore that's why they're having to do this almost as a kind of rearguard defensive action against the possibility they might only end up with four MPs or something. They're trying to preempt that happening. What are your thoughts on that?
I think some of it comes along the same lines of yours, and that I think you can make that argument that there's this great pool of, you know, there's this pool of talent out there who could be leader, but, and in an ideal world, you could be in the situation where you've sort of seen some, you know, Canada, I think, have seen, done it. They've done it, and then basically someone's retired, and they've won a by-election, and then they're in Parliament, the leader of the party, you know, this new leader who's come over outside. However, Liberal Democrats aren't in that position where you can sort of gift a seat to someone. So
they can hold on to what they've got, yeah.
But that's it. And then, but the problem is, I think you get then, you know, someone gets elected as leader, and then you're asking the question, you know, the first question they're going to get is, right, so how are you going to get in the House of Commons? Because, like it or not, our system is based around the House of Commons, and, you know, and the leader being there. And the examples of the broad upper parties that don't do it are either really small, or have really small, yeah, like UKIP and the Greens have had very small, has or have very small parliamentary representation, or it's the SNP and Plaid and the Northern Irish parties whose focus is in Westminster.
And there the expectation would be with the SNP that the leader would be a member of the Scottish Parliament and Wales, the Welsh Parliament.
Yeah, exactly.
Because there isn't an equivalent for the Lib Dems.
There isn't, yeah.
There's not some other parliament that the Lib Dems can be part of.
We're a national party. You know, and so I think that's the problem, is that everyone is going to then, you know, your leader is there. You know, you've then, I think, got a double problem on, you know, we always have that focus generally on the leader's seat, you know, well, recently anyway. You know, there was big focus on Westmorland, and if you read the stuff that was in The Guardian yesterday about the party having to reorganise a lot of the stuff in the campaign to make sure Tim Farron held his seat, and there was a lot of panic in 2015 about trying to make sure Nick Clegg held his seat there. You've then got a double thing. First, you've actually got to identify where this person's going to stand, and second, you've got to actually try and win a seat, and then, you know, from scratch, or do it, you know, unless you've handed over Twickenham to them or something.
So it sounds a bit like you are of the view that if a leader is elected who isn't an MP, the job one is get them elected as an MP, rather than think that they would be able to just do the job from the outside of
Parliament. Well, I think that's going to be the expectation from the press, or it's going to be the question they're going to be asking constantly, is why, you know, for a party that purports to be campaigning to be a major national parliamentary force, is Woz your leader not in Parliament then?
Farage failed to get elected to Parliament 7 times, and he was still a very effective UKIP leader, wasn't he?
But he was in the European Parliament.
That's true.
But I think, again, it's do we want to be UKIP?
I think you've got, but then again,
that's a party probably order of magnitude smaller than the Liberal Democrats. Again, so you've got that, you know, their only other choice if you're going to have a parliamentary leader was Mark Reckless or Douglas Carswell.
Mark Reckless only for a few months as well.
Yeah, so there's always that issue with them, was that, you know, when Farage has been, you know, sorry, I'm trying to remember what point there. But yeah, So, I think the issue you have with that is that it's going to be... And then you've also got, if the leader's an outside Parliament and trying to do that, you've still got to have a leader of the parliamentary group.
Yeah.
He's doing all that. And then, you know, they're not malicious in doing it, but journalists are going to be keeping an eye on what the two say, and if there's any diversion between them, it's like, well, who's the real leader?
Well, the SNP has that issue, don't they? Because Nicola Sturgeon is the leader and First Minister in Scotland, but they have a Westminster leader, don't they, as well? So they seem to manage that okay. I've not seen loads of stories about splits between the SNP leader in Westminster and Nicola Sturgeon. They seem to manage that okay.
Yeah, I suppose that you can manage it. I just think that they could, with the SNP or with Plaid or with that, I think you could get, you know, if it happens, it's a problem. And I think the question you're having is then, why aren't any of the 12 good enough to be leader?
Yeah.
But also, what is so special about some of these people outside that makes them leave? Because one thing I think you notice in politics, and it's not just in Britain, it's all around the world, is generally you can see lots of people saying, so-and-so is a success in business, in the military, in education, whatever. They'd be great in politics, and most of the time they're not.
The current incumbent of the White House is perhaps a good example of that.
But you can look in other terms, in those who've just not even got that far, who stood for election, you know, in Britain you have people like Archie Norman.
Yeah.
He was a big, successful businessman, went into politics and, you know, had a middle ranking job. And then, you know, and then again, you've got these people who sort of, political leadership, in my opinion, is a very specific, it's a leadership skill, but I don't think leadership is completely transferable between, you know, I think political leadership has some specific skills that you need to develop over time. And I don't think that a lot of these people being, the idea that this, there's some magical person out there who could lead the party from outside to success, you know, is there. And I think the problem is, I think there's this hope that there's some figure out there that might do it. And, you know, I may be missing it. There may be some person out there who's desperate to do it.
Well, what you say there, that's an interesting point, because that reminds me of something. I remember writing about this at the time. Which is, do you remember when Gordon Brown became Labour leader and he was going on about government of all the talents, the goats they were referred to as? And there were various people he appointed to various positions as advisors.
Digby Jones,
but there was also Shriti Vadera, do you remember her, Baroness Vadera? Now, she'd been some big wig in economics somewhere. I think she'd been in business or she'd been in academia. She was very good on economics. And there was an interview, it was Alistair Stewart, ITV, who... He's obviously a very long-standing ITV anchor, but also a kind of political correspondent as well. And I think it was 2008 or 2009 when there'd been the financial crisis and they were talking about, you know, are we starting to come out of it? And he was interviewing her live on television and he said, are we starting to see some green shoots coming through? And immediately my political alarm bell started ringing in the back of my head because I remember Norman Lamont getting into trouble in 1993 for talking about green shoots of recovery. And she fell into the trap that Alistair Stewart set. She said, I think we are seeing some green shoots. And immediately it was all about, it's Lamont Mark II, it's complacency. Now, she's not a political operator. Someone who'd come up through the SPAD route would have known immediately, that's a trap, I'm not going to fall into that trap. So people who aren't experienced in politics, whether it's to do with leadership, or whether it's just to do with understanding where the landmines are in the questions you're being asked by journalists. And it's, you know, it's just, I'm obsessed with politics and I have been for 20 or 25 years. So I was aware of that. But it's not really fair to expect someone who's maybe coming from the outside, who maybe is bringing external skills from academia or business or whatever, to expect where all of those landmines, to know where all those landmines are, but at the same time, wanting the skills and experience, but they have to suffer the same the same journalistic rites of passage as, you know, elected politicians who've come up through the more traditional route. So I think that it's very difficult to see how this would work at all in that respect, really.
Yeah, and I just think of it in terms of the other thing. One thing someone's pointed out is that it could be councillors and other people who are politicians. But I think the point is that there's very few non-MP politicians with any sort of public profile.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just trying to think a bit there. And sort of you've got really, you know, if you ask people, yeah, they can name the mayor of London.
Mm.
Maybe name the mayor of Manchester.
Yeah.
But then he was an MP. And both those are MPs. And then, yeah, who's the mayor of West Midlands?
Didn't he used to be an MP? I can't remember his name now. I'm not sure. It's a good question, and I'm obsessed with politics, and I don't even know.
Andy Street. And he was an MP. He worked for John Lewis.
He was an MP.
No, he worked for John Lewis.
Ah, right.
Before he became mayor of the West Midlands.
I'm thinking of the other guy then.
Andy Burnham. Guy
who was running. No, Andy Burnham for Manchester.
Oh, Sean Simon.
That was it.
He was the thing, when you're looking, yeah, there's, you know, I'm a councillor, and in my area, there's people who don't know I'm a councillor. You know, I know I meet people in Colchester who don't know I'm a councillor, and they, you know, you're not well, you know, local government isn't well known in its own area, and that's it. So there's this thing of sort of whoever you, if you decided to go that route and at least choose another politician, you've then still got someone you've got to build a national profile from nothing, and then you've got all that focus on the job they're trying to do as well, locally.
Yeah.
I think with the Liberal Democrat, you know, I think it'd be interesting from the academic viewpoint is to actually see how that works for the Greens. We've now got two, you know, Sean Berry and John Bartley,
yeah,
who are both councillors in London, is how being leader affects their profile as councillors and how that, what attention that gets for their sort of local work, or even if how much that gets noticed. But I think there is that, but again, yeah, there is that bit of, it's that question of profile.
Yeah.
And the point is, whoever you elect as leader is going to have to spend a lot of time in Westminster anyway, because that's where the media is.
Yeah, it's true. It's always the problem, isn't it? Just to wrap up then, do you think that these changes are going to happen? I mean, it's out of consultation, but it's a done deal, basically, isn't it?
I think it's interesting. I've noticed quite a few people are a bit sceptical about them. However, so I think I've got a feeling that something like them will go through. I think there will be some changes before they end up getting proposed. However, it's the route in which they get proposed as well, I think, is going to be interesting to see, because there's been talk about member ballots and special conferences. It's how much they get changed as a result of the consultation. And then what happens next is, do they leave them till the spring conference, or do they try and find a mechanism to push them through before that comes along? And yeah, I think we need to see what comes after that. And I think one interesting thing is going to be to see Vince's speech on Tuesday.
Yeah.
How much he actually sort of takes on board any of the criticism.
Well, by the time this podcast is released, the jury will be in on that. So our listeners will be ahead of us on that. Anyway, thanks very much for your time, Nick.
That's okay, Mark. Thank you. Sorry.
So now I'm joined by Mark Pack, who is editor of Lib Dem Newswire and former editor of Lib Dem Voice, and also co-author of 101 Ways to Win an Election. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. It's lovely to see you again, Mark.
Yeah, and you. You've obviously been a guest on this podcast before. This is a bit of a special one that I'm kind of interviewing people at conference. So, I think we should probably start with your feelings about how things are going at this conference at the moment. Obviously, there's been the talk about changing the rules as regards party membership, and there's also been discussion of potentially changing the rules as regards how the leader is elected. What's your take on how things are going down here?
I mean, I think in many ways the conference has been pretty successful so far. They're sort of really good attendance, huge numbers of people at fringe events and so on, and generally people in pretty good mood. The thing that perhaps is a little bit odd about it is when you think that what Vince Cable said about his party leadership, that he is almost certain, therefore, to stand down as leader next year. And therefore, this is basically our last autumn conference before the next party leadership.
I mean, that's a very interesting...
There isn't that buzz of speculation and intrigue and rumour that you might otherwise think you should have.
I haven't particularly picked up on that. I've been spoken to a few people. In the headlines, you see it's described as until 2022, because that's conceivably when the Parliament could run to. But actually, if you kind of parse what he said and you think about it, it probably does mean that within a year there'll be a leadership conference.
Absolutely. And part of what he said, which I think is really sensible, is, look, if there's an early general election next year, he will be as leader and he will fight it and be fully committed. But also what we are quite likely to see next year is a Conservative Party leadership election. I think Theresa May, don't play this back at me when she's ousted 2 weeks after this podcast is broadcast.
Maybe
Theresa May, Theresa May, currently Prime Minister, is pretty much likely to be in post until the Article 52 year period is up. But then there are clearly huge numbers of people in the Conservative Party itching to change leader. And the point at which the Tory party have a leadership election, the overwhelming logic for the Lib Dems will be, look, have our leadership election now as well. Because if we hold off and have it later, the risk is the Tories have their leadership election, new Tory prime minister has a bit of a honeymoon period, then tries to force a general election. And then we're stuck in this horrible no man's land of not having yet elected a new leader and yet having a leader who said they probably didn't want to be leader all the way through the next parliament. So I think almost certainly this is the last Dalton conference before we have a change of leader. We've, in a way, seen some of the obvious potential leadership candidates sort of on display. I'd say they've all had good conferences in their own way. Ed Davey headed up the relatively controversial online immigration paper. The reason I say online is actually when it came to the debate in the hall, with some amendments admittedly being passed to it, actually the overall immigration motion passed very, very easily. But so in that sense, Ed has got his big policy thing through. Leila Moran, another often talked about person, really popular, effective speech that she gave on education, particularly having a little bit in the firing line, grammar schools and the tax breaks for private schools and the like. Jo Swinson, party deputy leader, she gave a speech that roamed across a far wider range of policy areas than, as it were, her normal remit. So maybe she had a little bit of an eye to the next leadership election with that broad-ranging speech, but that went down really well. So I think when you sort of prod people a little bit and think, well, you know, okay, is when there's a next leadership election, you know, who do you think is going to be in the running? How do you feel about who the field might be? I think generally people are reasonably happy that there could be a really good choice. What I think there is will be a very strong feeling of is, oh my goodness, we have to have a contest of some sort. But you know, having an uncontested leadership election twice in a row would just really not be good for the party, not be good for whoever ends up leader, and it really wouldn't be a good look to the public outside as well.
Yeah. What are your thoughts about this idea of having the ability for people to just join the party, but not even join it, just give an email address, and as long as you're on the electoral roll, then you are able to participate in leadership contests?
I think the broad idea of creating a registered supporter scheme, something I've been banging on about for about 3 years now. David Howarth, former MP for Cambridge, and I wrote a pamphlet about how the party should have a core vote strategy in 2015, just after the 2015 election, and this was part of what we said in that we should have a registered supporter scheme. So that broad direction I'm very keen on, because actually political parties far too often are rather too closed and too hostile to the outside world. But also, you look at our most successful local parties, things like Leila Moran's, Oxford West and Abingdon, they run a de facto registered supporter scheme at the moment. And you talk to sort of some of the key organisers in the local party there, it has been absolutely central to their success. In part, the reason we have Leila Moran as an MP and a potential future leader of the party is because we had a registered supporter scheme by default, wasn't quite called that, in her constituency for several years. So I think the overall principle is a really good one. Myself, I am a little bit sort of lukewarm about the idea that both anyone could stand for leader and all the registered supporters can vote for leader, because I think that combination makes us too liable to entryism or mischief making of some sort. And I think particularly that's an issue if you look at it from the perspective of, say, fellow party members in Scotland, where you think just how nasty and poisonous a lot of the online atmosphere can be around issues about independence in Scotland. And you think if you take some of those people, if they deliberately, for the lols, as it were, decide to carry out vandalism on another party, that we need a much better answer about how do we deal with entryism, etc. I think, you know, that said, I am a liberal. And I think it is, you know, we shouldn't simply say, well, we don't think something is a good idea, therefore it should be banned. So I'm happy about the idea that our rules should allow a non-MP to stand for leader. Because even if you think that is always going to be a bad choice, that's not a good enough reason for banning it and making it illegal in that sense. But I do think we should have, you know, we need to have some safeguards. And for me, the best safeguard is that candidates for leader need to be nominated by a certain number of MPs. Or maybe extend that to be MPs, MSPs, AMs, in appropriate deference to the fact that we are a more devolved country and we believe we should be much more devolved than we are. I think that would provide a really important safeguard, that you therefore have got protection against entryism and vandalism, because you have a filter to be sure that the candidates are a good field of candidates. Now, of course, if we do that, the MPs would need to take their nomination more seriously than, frankly, some Labour MPs took their power in previous Labour contests. But in a way, I think everyone across all parties has learned the lesson for that. You really only should nominate as a candidate somebody who you really think is up to the job. So I think if we do that, I'm reasonably relaxed about the idea that that a broader pool of people should be able to vote for leader. We definitely do need some gradations. For me, that's a real strength. You know, if it's not simply a black or white, you're a member, you're not, just a forced binary choice. To have, yeah, you know, you might be a regular voter for us, you might help a bit by putting up posters, etc. You might be a supporter, you might be a member. We do need some differences between member and supporter. But I do worry a little bit when some people talk about it as if anyone who's not a member somehow isn't properly committed to the party. Because there are deliverers who give hours and hours, week after week, and have all sorts of reasons why they might not join the party. And just occasionally some of the comments people who oppose these plans make do sound a little bit disrespectful of people who give hours and hours to the party, week in, week out, month in, month out, but for whatever reason have chosen not to be a member. And I think we should be massively grateful to those people.
That's how I started. I mean, I'm not a Lib Dem anymore, as you know, and as the listener.
I have a membership form, however, in my pocket.
Well, I have thought about it, but at the moment it wouldn't be right for me. But I was a member from 2008 to 2013.
And one of our best bloggers when you were.
Well, thank you very much. Very kind of you to say so. For about 2 years before I joined, I would regularly go over to Guildford and I would help Sue Doughty's team delivering leaflets. And, you know, that was kind of what introduced me to getting into the party. It was kind of a gateway drug that got me into joining the Lib Dems. Yeah. And I think, you know, there's probably a little bit of that.
Or just to give an example from outside politics, I, for example, am a member of the Friends of Parklands Walk, at least I think I am. So, which actually makes the point all the better. So near me, where I live in North London, is a disused railway line that is now, I think the modern terminology is a linear park. It's basically a really nice little bit of countryside in the middle of a city. And there is a local Friends of group. I have occasionally given them money, and I think they're a good thing, and I'm happy to support them. I think I'm a member. I'm not 100% sure if I'm a member or not. And I certainly don't know exactly what my legal rights are in that sense. Do I can't remember having received a ballot paper or an email about an election or an AGM, so I guess I probably don't. But that is a very normal situation for a lot of people in terms of organisations they're members of, is that you don't sit down to think about, am I going to back this environmental pressure group? Well, let's have a look in detail about what its constitution says and what rights I get and what voting rights. That's just not how people engage with organisations. Part of your reason for donating or signing up as a member or in some way signing up to back is there's a whole load of emotional things as well as practical things about, well, I want to support this cause and there are particular ways I feel I'm comfortable doing that. And I think we need to reflect that in the range of options we give people as to how they wish to engage with the Lib Dems. Some will be want to be absolutely full on. Some might be a little bit reticent. Some might want to, you know, maybe agree with us on 95% of things. And that's fine, and therefore they're willing to go full on. But for some people, that 5% might be 20%, or the 5% might be something that's really important to them. And so they want to sort of half agree with us, but not feel like they're somehow signing up to everything. So we need to have a range of options to meet that range of different perspectives and preferences that people have. It's a liberal solution, after all.
So, Mark, I also noticed that you wrote a blog post about how the media covers party conferences. And I know that's something, you know, that you've been interested in for a long time, and indeed in your kind of day job, you know, political communications, it's kind of linked to all of that, isn't it? And there's media here as well. There's always media at political conferences. I mean, how do you think the coverage is going in general? Yeah,
well, there was a fascinating bit of round of media coverage for the Lib Dem conference the day after we had a big consultation session with Vince Cable about his party reforms package. And the thing that really caught my eye and therefore made me write the blog post was the piece in the Mirror. Because the Mirror's piece was firstly titled Exclusive, and I thought, oh, this is interesting. I wonder what they discovered or think they've discovered about the party reform plan. It was then a piece that was simply a report of that consultation session. Now, that consultation session was held in the conference hotel, where, in fact, we were recording this podcast. There were no security checks on the door, so it was open to anyone, any journalist, any lost hotel resident, any board member, hotel staff, and several hundred members and journalists in the room. So it wasn't a secret meeting in any way. So it's a little bit cheeky to describe, to label a write-up of an event with several hundred people that's open to anyone as somehow being an exclusive. But the other thing which I loved, which was a really nice example of the way the media operates, was the story then referred to a party reform plan document seen by the Mirror. Now, seen by the Mirror, I've no doubt a Mirror journalist has seen the document, so it's technically true. But seen by suggests a little bit of sleuthing, doesn't
yeah,
it?
It suggests you've kind of furtive.
Exactly. The document involved is actually a public document. Not only is it a public document of which there were piles of copies at the back of the room, it's a public document that's on the party website, has been for a week or two, and it's the party document that Vince Cable held a press conference about. So to have somebody hold a press conference about something and then to write it up as seen by is a little bit true, but it helps. It's a really nice illustration, I think, of the understandable, in some way, pressures journalists are under to sex up their stories.
Yeah.
Even at this relatively benign level of trying to make a Liberal Democrat document sound more interesting. Mm. And frankly, if you're a journalist with that as your job to report, you can see why you might be tempted. But it is also problematic, because seen by is not, I think it's fair to say, it's not really playing fair by the reader, because it does imply something extra. And in particular, if you're a Lib Dem, you know, if you're interested in the story, the problem with seen by suggests it's a document that you're not going to be able to get a hold of copy of because it's somehow secret.
Yeah.
Well, actually, if you're interested in the story, much better if it was a link through to the document and then readers who are interested can follow up on it. And I was particularly looking out for examples of how the media coverage conference like that, because at the moment I'm actually working part-time in my day job trying to write a book on how to understand the news. Think of it as sort of Ben Goldacre meets Tim Harford. If I want to be a bit egotistical about my writing skills, are definitely not in there.
Two of my favourite authors, exactly. So I think you've already got one sale.
I just need to finish writing the book now. But I think there is a lot that is really helpful if you do want to really understand what's going on in the world, to be able to understand how news stories are put together and the sorts of pressures that even well-intentioned, generally honest journalists fall prey to. So one thing I talk about in the book, as I've written it so far, is that journalists often think of themselves as a profession, and they have many of the general attributes of a profession, but in one crucial way are very different from, say, doctors or lawyers. That with both doctors and lawyers, at the heart of the profession is the idea that you must be honest. So a GP telling a lie to a patient would be seen as a really big black mark against them. Even though, because of what we know about, say, the placebo effect, actually my GP lying to me that they've really got a bit of medicine that's going to make me better, that's the placebo effect, might actually make me better. But at the heart, there is this idea that honesty is central to both those professions. That's not central to journalism in anything like the same way. Part of journalism is get the story. And actually, fibbing a little bit, lying a little bit, whatever, is seen as acceptable, partly because sometimes you are trying to unearth a story that someone else is wrongly trying to keep secret. But at the heart of journalism, there isn't that same ethical perspective on the world. And I think there's a whole load of interesting implications from that. But I'll just give you an example. Once you think of it this way, is if you look at journalism textbooks, they are all memoirs of journalists. They are stuffed full of stories that basically eulogise somebody lying, without really talking about the full ramifications and the possible drawbacks. So one standard journalism textbook I was reading a couple of weeks ago talks about how a journalist pretended to be an FBI agent. He stuck a notepad under his armpit to make it look like the bulge where you might have a gun under your armpit. Pretended to be an FBI agent and bluffed his way into a hospital, essentially lied, misled the staff there to get access to private medical records. Now, just the way I've described it, you sort of think, there are maybe some ethical issues about this. The way the journalist textbook described it is all as positive. This brilliant, imaginative, resourceful journalist managed to get access to these records, which, to be fair to them, they would justify as what those hospital records showed was that the state authorities in the US had been lying about what had happened with a police incident in which people had been shot. So you can see the justification for lying and cheating, in that sense, to get the story. But there are some decent ethical questions, like should the journalist or their editor have to first check maybe with the relatives of the people? Is it okay to sort of con your way into seeing private medical records of somebody else, even without any reference to their family or the great, you know, that there are ethical issues that you should have to work through and think about. And it's really striking when you look at things like journalist textbooks, how little attention is given to that ethical side.
It's very interesting.
Compared to doctors and lawyers, where there
is. No, I take your point. It's maybe not something I've thought about at that level of detail before. I mean, the whole phone hacking scandal, I think, exposed how endemic the sorts of, you know, underhand methods you've just described were. I mean, they were literally hacking the phone, the mobile phone records of dead children who'd been murdered. And that just seemed to be... It almost feels like once they've crossed a certain Rubicon, almost anything
is game. And that's the risk, isn't it? Because you can start off with the best of intent. And this is one of the reasons why the idea of a doctor lying to a patient is considered so much forbidden territory, because you can definitely think of circumstances where the doctor lying to the patient you might justify, and the patient may even be better for it. But the problem is, once you say that isn't our dividing line, it is so easy to just slip further and further away, and then you end up lying in situations which are anything but justifiable. Woodward and Bernstein are a good example of this in the journalistic area. You know, most political journalists will probably slightly dream secretly about how they might be Woodward and Bernstein one day. And yet the basic story about Woodward and Bernstein is two American journalists who, through their brilliant investigative journalism, brought down a US president. The truth is a bit more messy. It's like actually quite a lot of the stories that they broke were about an investigative process that was running anyway. But definitely, you know, they are admirable people. You know, if I was to grow up to be Woodward or Bernstein, you know, I think, I feel I've done a good contribution to society. But part of what they did, which is almost never mentioned, is they lied to one of their sources to con their source into giving them information they didn't want to. Now, again, I think you can probably justify that in terms of bringing down a president and what the president had done, what the story was they were trying to unearth. But in a way, the Woodward and Bernstein story, to me, at the heart of it should be this, they did something, some things that are morally questionable that maybe should be justified. But if you're eulogising Woodward and Bernstein, you also need to think about what are the ethical implications of, was it really okay for them to lie to their source? And if it was, come up with a set of restrictions on why you think that was okay but would stop you lying to your sources on lots of other occasions. And again, that tends to be missing from the Woodward and Bernstein story.
Yeah. So when do you think this book's going to be out then? Because you're obviously partway through it.
Yeah, so I've completed a draft.
Okay.
So quantity, tick. Quality to be decided. I guess it'll hopefully be sometime next year, sometime in 2019, because I'm currently going through the process of finding an agent and a publisher. So anyone listening, specialise in non-fiction books,
probably
fancy a cross between a Tim Harford and a Ben Goldacre, but not quite as good as either, then do get in touch. Hopefully next year.
Okay. Well, Mark Pack, thank you very much for your time.
Lovely talking to you again, Mark.
And now I'm delighted to be joined by John Elledge, who is a journalist for The New Statesman. Hi, John.
Hello, how are we doing?
Good, good. So thank you for taking a little bit of time out from your busy conference schedule to speak to us. What is your take on what you've seen and heard so far at the conference?
The thing I'm curious about is I'm trying to work out what the party en masse wants the leadership to be doing, what they think the exercise is for at this point, because I can't really see any consensus as to whether they're trying to come up with a program for government, or like whether it's about sort of acting as a sort of pressure group to kind of get more sort of liberal values into the other party's manifestos, or whether it's frankly a drinking society and talking shop. Like, all of those are, I think there are people who are kind of buying into all of those arguments, but there didn't seem to be any particular consensus. I always find it quite entertaining at Lib Dem conference, the amount of energy that goes into very slight changes of wording and all these passionate speeches that people make about how you must support Amendment 3 to line 69-71 or whatever it is, as if it's in some way meaningful. Whereas my suspicion is outside the conference hall, it kind of isn't really. I don't think, even in terms of like winning over voters, I don't think the sort of median potential Lib Dem voter is going to be poring over exactly what is in a Lib Dem policy statement. It's like, you know, three or four stages of the process between like the words being written and what will actually be received by potential voters. So it always feels like there's a sort of slight mismatch between the level of importance kind of attached to these things in the room and the way it actually works in the so-called real world. But, you know, they're a nice bunch. Everyone seems to be having a good time. Isn't that the point, really?
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to say that, you know, it might be a legacy, a kind of hangover from the time that the party was in coalition, when what the party's policies were actually probably did have some meaning and some effect in terms of what was happening nationally. But having been a veteran of Lib Dem conferences before they were in coalition, they've always been like that. They always think that their policies matter and are going to make a huge difference. And
yeah.
I think they probably do overestimate how much reach they have in that respect.
I think it's like it's a combination of a sort of cultural thing. Like it's a very democratic party, obviously, and like, you know, within, in terms of like what the party sort of writes down that it believes in, obviously what they said in that room does have an impact.
Yeah.
And I think people then lose sight of the fact that it's a bit of a bubble.
Yeah.
Like even in the already sort of tiny world of British politics as a whole, the Lib Dems are like a bubble within a bubble. So.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. So have you been picking up anything from people on the suggestions about the changes to the way the party is going to allow kind of associate membership, and also Vince Cable's idea about opening up the leadership to potentially people who aren't MPs?
I mean, it's difficult to know how representative the people I've spoken to are. Also, like, the people I've spoken to tend to be from the sort of younger end of the party. So I don't know how representative they are. But the impression I have is that those are two slightly different issues, and that people are more open to the idea of some form of associate membership and kind of widening the franchise as it is, than they are to the idea of a non-parliamentary leader, which I think people find a bit sort of strange and baffling, just in terms of the functioning of the party. But the flip side of that is that, I mean, if you look at what happened with, like, Theresa May or Gordon Brown before, like, both of them are, I think, seen as suffering in part because they didn't really have to win a leadership campaign in any significant sense to get to where they were. And that probably sort of led to a certain weakening of authority later when things started to go wrong. I have heard the argument from a couple of people, one of whom admittedly was Vince Cable, that one of the strongest arguments to sort of opening up the field of potential leaders is that when Leila Moran or Joe Swinson, whoever it is, actually becomes leader, they will be able to say, look, we beat this wider range of people, rather than it being another sort of coronation or near coronation, which seems to be the sort of standard around here.
That's an interesting point, actually. I've not heard anyone else express that, because, I mean, realistically, the field is only 10 people, isn't it? Because two of the parliamentary party, they've got 12. Two of them have already been leader.
Yeah.
So they've got a field of 10, and if it's Joe Swinson, Leila Moran, maybe Norman Lamb wants to have another go, I don't know.
Yeah, you knock out the ones that, like, I'm told that I have been, I'm not going to name names because I don't know whether this is true, but I've been told there is at least one name who is widely discussed who doesn't particularly want it, and another MP who very much does want it, but has been told they shouldn't have it by the powers that be. So I think the field is actually probably even narrower than it looks. And it's, so I don't know. I kind of think like the recent history of political parties sort of like, you know, widening the franchise to non-members has a mixed result. Even if you just look at the Labour Party, I think it's fairly mixed in that in some ways that's been incredibly effective. And, you know, they did quite well in 2017.
Well, that's the thing.
In other ways,
that,
it's possibly detonating the party. So it could go either way, really.
I mean, I would have said about Corbyn it was an utter disaster until last year when he nearly won. And then it was weird, actually, because my youngest brother, he's about 4.5 years younger than me, and he's never been interested in politics at all. And then in the run-up to the 2017 election, he kept going on about Corbyn, about how brilliant Corbyn was, and Corbyn this, and Corbyn that. And I was thinking, what's going on here? And then I was telling him, like, Corbyn's got no chance. You'll see, they'll just bring out, they'll have all the pictures of him with members of the IRA, and was on stage with Hamas, and they'll just utterly destroy him. And then he called me about a week before the election, he said, I just went to a Corbyn rally in Runcorn, and they were queuing round the block and down the street, and I was thinking, am I missing something here, right? Is he picking up on something I'm not? And then lo and behold, you know, he did phenomenally well compared to what I thought he was going to do. So, you know, maybe there is something to having, widening the franchise of who chooses the leader. I don't know.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, I think with the Corbyn thing, I think it is true that the political media class as a whole definitely did miss something, but like it wasn't just because like there are a small number of arseholes being arsehole-y to you on the internet, that doesn't mean that there is not a much wider pool of people that support something. And like a lot of the stuff, like all the stuff around the IRA, the problem is like we're now like a whole generation past the Good Friday Agreement, and it's like this stuff just doesn't have the salience it did 40 years ago.
Which I didn't realise, like, because I grew up in the middle of the Troubles, and I lived in Runcorn when the Warrington bomb went off, you know, it was very, very close to me. And also my grandfather on my mum's side was from Dublin, and he was, you know, very heavily in favour of a United Ireland. So I was very aware of all of this stuff, but you go down 10 or 20 years from where I am, and yeah, I think it just doesn't have the cut through. And I didn't predict that. I thought it still would.
Yeah, I mean, it's 20 years since Good Friday Agreement. You have to be over 30, 35, I think, to have any sort of memory of it as a live political issue. And that does kind of like weaken the salience of it. So I think there was I think like a lot of other people, did misread the wider appeal of Corbynism. And I think also there is definitely a hunger for some form of change. I think like the crash followed by austerity and the housing crisis and flatlining wages and student debt and like all these things have just kind of like combined into this sort of general sense that like things are a bit rubbish and people would like them not to be rubbish. And so parties saying, you know, actually it's going to keep being like this, just put up with it, are going to lose votes to someone who says like, well, this can be different, this should be different. And like, you know, okay, maybe I'm still not sold on a lot of the policies. I'm really not sold on like a lot of foreign policy stuff, or God help us, like there's all the stuff around anti-Semitism, which I think is genuinely dreadful. But I think a lot of the stuff around the sort of economic offer is popular for quite rational reasons, and just saying, well, this isn't going to work is probably not actually that good an argument, because for a lot of people, like, the status quo is not working either.
Yeah, and actually, you know, if you were to talk to my youngest brother, that is his view. You know, he thinks that the policies that Corbyn is espousing from an economic perspective would be really good. Maybe not even personally for him. I think he's doing okay, but, you know, he lives in a place where there is quite a lot of deprivation in the town, and, you know, I think he genuinely wants things to be better for other people, and he sees Corbyn as a vehicle to do that. He's probably not wrong, to be honest.
I mean, I think the Tories are still sort of instinctively falling back on, like, this don't let Labour wreck it argument.
Yeah.
And that's kind of ignoring the fact that firstly it kind of comes pre-wrecked for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And secondly, like, you know, with all the Brexit stuff going on, it's probably about to get a lot worse. And so, you know, steady as she goes is not an argument that you can compellingly use when, like, everything is a disaster, you know?
Yeah, it's weird. It's kind of upside down world, isn't it? Conservatives with a small C are usually the ones who don't want anything to change.
Yeah.
And the other parties are the ones who are agitating for change, and now it's completely flipped over. The Tories are the ones who are dragging us into God knows what, and the other parties are like, hang on a minute.
You've got a radical anti-business Conservative Party.
Yeah.
While John McDonnell is going around saying to businesses, yeah, we want to raise taxes a little bit, but we're not going to destroy the system.
Yeah.
It is like we're through the looking glass.
That's exactly the phrase I was just thinking of. Just before we wrap up, I don't know if you've heard about the policy that going through about reform to business rates. So it's kind of like a form of land value tax, but for businesses. They've not called it that. They've not called it land value tax. They've got some other name for it, but it is basically that. I just wondered, with your kind of city metric hat on, because that's one of the things that you do in the New Statesman, isn't it? You're kind of city metric editor. How you see that sort of reform, you know, as it relates to cities, because it would have a big effect on cities, wouldn't it?
I will say up front, this is one of those areas I don't know enough about and should know more of, so I might be about to embarrass myself terribly. I think the current system does not work brilliantly. Like, it does incentivize, like, demolition sometimes. You shouldn't be like, just piss out. It means that there's a liability for leaving something empty, for example. I don't know if like changes for land value tax would have any impact on that, but I think there is certainly an argument for reform. But I kind of think like so many of the conversations I've had both here and elsewhere recently around areas I'm interested in, like housing, like transport, do come back to like, well, the problem is basically need local government to be doing a bunch of stuff again that they can't afford to do. So I would be interested in kind of a wider package of reforms to kind of give local government more power over their own affairs, because as it stands, they're just like, they're, the sort of costs they're facing from social care especially, but other things as well, have been ramping up and up and up. Austerity has cut like half their budget, and the big financial reform for them for the last few years has been, well, if you grow your business rate, you can keep the extra, which is brilliant if you're a rich Tory council, but not much good if you're literally anything else. And over the next, like, we've already seen, what was it, Northamptonshire,
yeah,
wasn't it, that fell over?
They're starting to fail, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah. We're sat in sunny Brighton. East Sussex is a name I keep hearing as probably next in line. Over the next year, we're probably going to see half a dozen go.
Yeah.
And sooner or later, the penny is going to drop that it's not individual incompetence. It's like, you know, the government has just set them an impossible task.
Yeah, when it's one or two, you can make that argument. When, yeah, it's, when it's half a dozen or a dozen, that becomes...
Yeah, that's harder. It's the result of austerity. And kind of like, you know, a reasonably, or one of the less painful, politically painful fixes to that would be to say, okay, maybe we should let local councils raise a bit of their own tax again in some way. Because that way, like, just as, like, through austerity, Osborne was said to be devolving the axe, this is kind of like devolving the tax raises. So I don't know, maybe we will start to see those wider fiscal reforms. But there's so much on the government's plate at the moment with Brexit. I think, you know, predictions at this point are a complete mugger game, to be honest. So, like,
who knows? I keep getting asked when I get invited on the radio, what's going to happen about this, what's going to happen about that? And I just point out, I didn't predict Brexit, I didn't predict Trump, I didn't predict Corbyn, I didn't predict the result of the 2015 or 2017 general election. Don't ask me for predictions.
Yeah.
The tectonic plates are shifting so rapidly that, you know, there's no point.
I have occasionally felt tempted to go around predicting things I really don't want to happen, just because with my record on this stuff, it feels like the easiest way to make sure that, like, they don't.
I should probably go down the bookies and just put some money on something I definitely think isn't going to happen. Probably be quite profitable. Anyway, thanks very much for your time, John.
Thanks, good to talk to you.
So I'm delighted to be joined by Jenny Rigg, who is chair of LGBT plus Lib Dems. And also a member of the Lib Dem Federal Conference Committee. Hi, Jenny.
Hiya, Mark.
Thanks for joining me today. So, what is your take on what you've seen at conference so far? Just for context, it's the Tuesday morning, so it's the last day of conference. So you've already had a few days, and you had Glee Club last night.
Yeah,
which
I know
you're recovering from.
I am slightly hungover. I'm one of the people that hosts Glee Club, so it's like basically 3 hours of being on stage and singing rock asleep. My voice might be a little bit rough as well.
Just for context for anyone who doesn't know, Glee Club is, it's a way of kind of letting off steam towards the end of conference and singing rude songs about politicians both from other parties and also from your own party.
Yeah. We're equal opportunities, Mickey takers. We take the extract the urine is probably the politer way of putting it out of everybody, including ourselves.
Okay, good stuff. So, what's your take generally on kind of how conference has gone? Obviously, there's been the stuff that's been reported in the media about what Vince Cable and the leadership want in terms of members allowing this kind of affiliate membership status.
Yeah, the supporters scheme, yeah.
Yeah, and also future leadership contests, being able to open it out to have people other than MPs. Maybe get your thoughts on those.
I think that some of that could be interesting and some of it could be helpful. I don't think pushing all the proposals through at once is a particularly sensible idea. But in our party, the leader can't actually do that as much as he'd like to. There's going to be consultations, there's going to be... he's talking about doing an all-member ballot on it. It's going to have to come to conference, and it will have to be a two-thirds majority of conference voting for it, because it will be a constitutional change.
So do you think they'd end up having a special conference for that, or would that be spring conference? Because they seem to want this.
I think if they do try and call a special conference for it, I think that would be utter madness, because it costs a fortune, and the party is not rolling in it at the minute. Yeah, it'd be an enormous waste of money, and I think it would backfire on him because it would annoy people that we were wasting time and money on a special conference instead of just going out there and doing the actual politics that we want to be doing.
Mm. I mean, I have heard people describe it as a bit navel-gazing, this idea of kind of dealing with your internal structure. I mean, the way the media works is that's what they're reporting, because it's all through the prism of, you know, does that mean that the Lib Dems just think they're not going to have any MPs or hardly any MPs after the next election? And why is it that Vince is trying to open up the leadership ballot to non-MPs? Does he not think that any of his fellow MPs are up to the job? It's always filtered through a negative prism, this sort of thing, isn't it?
And but it's also that the media concentrates very much on what the leader thinks. And probably as a party, for us, what the leader thinks is the least important for any of the main parties.
I think a lot of people outside, having been a Lib Dem for a few years myself, as long-term listeners will remember, I think lots of people outside the party struggle to understand that, especially the media. It is all about what's the leader said, what does the leader think? And actually this party, maybe it was partly coloured by the fact that during coalition, Nick Clegg would just announce things and do things and it would happen because he was Deputy Prime Minister, he could make things happen. But when the party's not in government, it works very differently, doesn't
it? Yeah, it does. This has come entirely from the leader's office. It's not like the sort of bottom-up stuff that we're used to doing. And I don't know what it is, but there's something that's panicked them into thinking, oh my God, we've got to do something. We must do something, this is something, therefore let's do that. It's just such a Lib Dem response to, we're still hovering around 8 to 10% in the polls, and that's been for like 5 years now. It's quite depressing. But what members of the public want to know what we stand for. And it's such a Lib Dem thing to give a process answer to a values question. So the public are going to us, what do you stand for? And we're saying, well, make it easier for you to sign up. What is it that you stand for, though? We want to know what you stand for. Well, you can vote for the leader, and we're not answering the question that the public is asking.
It's very interesting because I keep seeing over and over on my Twitter timeline, I follow lots of different people, and I have lots of different people following me from all kinds of political persuasions and non. So I don't just, I at least try to not have this kind of filter bubble thing, and I get opinions from different people. And one of the things I keep seeing over and over again from people who are very well informed about lots of things, not necessarily the internal processes of the Lib Dems, but lots of other things, is Lib Dems, what do they stand for? They don't really stand for anything. I don't understand what the Lib Dems stand for. And then at the same time, because I follow people from the Lib Dems, I see people like yourself. I think you did a tweet a few days ago where you said, this is what we stand for, and then you quoted the beginning of the preamble to the Constitution about, you know, freedom from poverty and
ignorance and conformity.
I remember when I was a member, that preamble was very important to lots of members. Yeah. And it is a kind of stating of the fundamental precept, the principle, the underpinning foundations of the party. And yet so many people just don't seem to get that.
Yeah. And stuff like, I got up on the stage 2 days ago and did a speech to a motion quoting a rather large tract of On Liberty. And I have had so many people approach me about that and go, do you know, that's... I've never thought of it like that before. It's On Liberty. You know, it's like the Bible for Lib Dems.
Kind of isn't, though, is it? It's like it's people's ground, and I'm guilty of this, people's grounding in political philosophy is not maybe what it would have been 50 years ago when, you know, people, when they were getting maybe involved in parties or being activists in parties, they kind of wanted to understand the underpinning principles. Mm. Maybe it's because... politics is much more transactional nowadays, isn't it? It's like, what can this party do for me?
Yeah.
It's not necessarily, you know, what are the principles that are in this party? It's what am I going to get? Am I going to get an extra 100 quid a month in my pay packet from this party? It does kind of feel a little bit like we maybe lost something in that respect.
Maybe.
It's not just the Lib Dems.
But you can work from first principles and say, you know, from us, our offer to you is you will get better employment conditions, your landlord won't be able to screw you over as much, you know, why should we fight harder, let the landlords take the best? You know, we will stop unnecessary government intrusion, so you'll be more free to live your life how you want. It's selling it in a way that people will connect with, that I think as a party we fail at. We've got loads of really good policies, but we're not selling them to people.
And I suppose another part of the problem is that when you've got 12 MPs,
yeah,
and there are noises that make it seem like maybe the leadership is worried you might have fewer than 12 MPs,
yeah,
then people start to think, well, how likely is it that this party is actually going to implement this stuff?
Yeah, which, yeah.
Yeah, as a former member myself and still a fellow traveller, is frustrating. So what do you think about the likelihood of there being a leadership contest in, say, the next year or two?
I mean, Vince has said he's not going to stand down till he gets his reforms through, so if he doesn't get his reforms through...
Right. You know, I think then he'll just, in a kind of bitter peak, remain.
Potentially. And I think having a leadership election, like, immediately after or just before Brexit would be a really, really stupid navel-gazy thing to do. But then I think we sometimes do really stupid navel-gazy things, so...
Yeah,
I don't think it's likely, but I think, you know, there's a distant possibility.
Yeah. I suppose one of the potential issues here is that who knows what the Tories are going to do, because the Tories seem to have just gone absolutely batshit now.
Yeah.
But as regards Theresa May, they could defenestrate her very quickly after, yeah, Brexit. And if they do, and a new leader comes in, they might want their own electoral mandate, coast on the honeymoon, try, yeah, an actual majority. Now, Vince has said that he would remain leader under those circumstances.
Yeah.
Would you be happy with that? Would you be happy with him? Or would you rather actually it was someone else?
I mean, I wasn't ecstatic with the coronation of Vince anyway. I'm a Lib Dem. I like elections.
Yeah. So there would have to be an election this time.
The thing is, you can't force somebody to stand.
That's true. And so, that, again, would be a liberal. So there's, yeah, a kind of bound here.
Yeah. But it does strike me as something of an irony that we have an unelected leader who is trying to change the election rules for the leadership. Yeah, I think we do need, if we do get a leadership election, it does need to be an election. But it's who decides to throw their hat in the ring, you know? The prediction is... that it'll be between Jo Swinson and Leila Moran and maybe Ed Davey.
Yeah.
But, you know, Ed, people were pushing Ed to stand last time and he didn't, so he might not want to do it.
Yeah.
Leila, she's great, but she might feel she's not got enough parliamentary experience under her belt yet.
I mean, Leila's been in MP for just over a year, hasn't she?
Yeah. Yeah. And she's ace. She's really good.
Yeah.
But, you know... sometimes people feel they need to bed in a bit more before they...
Yeah.
And Jo's been an MP before. She knows what she's doing. She's a good speaker. I think she'd be the sort of sensible, moderate choice.
Yeah. It always feels like if it was Jo Swinson now and, say, in 5 or 10 years' time when Jo had had enough, maybe Leila... I didn't really know much about Leila Moran, but I was in a Fringe event yesterday and she spoke for a few minutes and... she just had star quality immediately.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want it to sound like a kind of X Factor beauty parade, but I could definitely see her as a future leader.
Yeah, she's really good at holding her room.
Yeah, you could see that immediately. And aside from anything else about principles and all that stuff, you have to have that thing.
Yeah.
If you haven't got that, then it's a non-starter anyway. We'll wrap up in a second, Jenny, because I know you've got to get off to do your job.
I've got a plan for a debate an hour.
Okay, well, we'll let you go, but just briefly, what's going to be your kind of main takeaway from this conference? I think every conference you go to, there's kind of a thing that you remember about it.
I think, actually, what I'm going to take away from this conference is that we've done a reasonably good job of putting actual controversial topics on the agenda, but there's been no massive fights and the party is reasonably united. I mean, there was some to-ing and fro-ing about the immigration motion, but actually, once we passed all the amendments, that then became acceptable. We've got party policy on abortion for the first time ever, because we've always shied away from discussing it because it's too thorny a topic before. We'd had a big animal rights motion. So, you know, we've had lots of things that are meaty topics that we've discussed, and actually the party's come together and been quite unified over them. So I'm quite pleased with that. As a member of conference committee, I'm really pleased that we've managed to actually have some serious debates and proper debates and come to some good principled conclusions.
Okay, great stuff. Thanks very much for your time, Jenny.
No worries.
So thanks once again to all my guests, to Nick Barlow, to Mark Pack, to John Elledge, and to Jenny Rigg. And thanks to you all for listening. I'd also like to thank Kevin MacLeod at incomputech.com for our theme music, and this has been a Political Human production.